We are in the middle of Perek Tet, chapter 9. Yeah, that's going to be fun today. Do I need the mic or am I all right? Yeah. Okay. We'll do a duet, me and the drill. The drill and I, however you want to say that. This chapter, or I should say this speech of Eov, chapters 9 and 10, is a really difficult read, and there's no way around it. The language itself is difficult, the grammar is difficult, the thoughts seem to go back and forth a little bit. It's not a simple read. I've done what I can with it, and I hope it's intelligible. Last week we began reading this speech of his. We saw the first part. It was chapter 9, sentences 1 to 13. If you're using the Art Scroll Tanakh, it's on page 1631. And he began by saying to Bildad, "You're right. You are 100% right. You know, Bildad has told him that God is just, no matter what you think, and he gave him two parables which teach that those who abandon God will collapse. He may have also taught that sometimes bad things happen, but they're ultimately positive, depending on how you read his second parable." So his response, the response that Job gives is, "Yeah, you're right. There's no winning a suit with God." But remember that he used the key verb, tzadi dalet kuf, in an interesting way. When he said that God is tzadik, and a person cannot be tzadik with God, it didn't have to mean God is righteous and I can't be righteous in my debate with God. It might mean tzadik is victorious, to win. And so what he's saying is, nobody can defeat God. Not because God is right, but because you're never going to win. And that's the theme that continues this week as we read the rest of his speech. Right here we're going to see a section in which he's going to explain why I can't win. So the section that we're going to read first is chapter 9, sentences 14 to 20. It starts at the bottom of page 1631 in the Art Scroll Tanakh. And he's going to give us two different reasons why he can't win. And as I said, this is a hard section to read. There are other ways to break up these lines besides the way that I did. But I think what I'm presenting is good. So we begin with sentences 14 to 16, in which he says, "I can't win because I can't believe that God is going to listen, and therefore I can't even voice my arguments. Why should I present my arguments against God when God isn't listening anyway?" Take a look at sentence 14. He begins by saying, "Av ki anochi e'enenu, evchara devarai imo." In the previous sentence, he said that God crushes Ozrei Rahav, those who help the great, people who are mighty. God crushes them. So, av ki anochi e'enenu, he says, "Me too. I certainly am not able to do this. I am certainly not able to respond to God. Ev chara devarai imo, to choose my words with him. Asher im tzadakti lo e'ene l'mshofti aschanan." He says, even if I could come up with an appropriate response to his charges, aki tzadakti, even if I could come up with a winning answer to God, I wouldn't be able to voice it to him. Lo e'eneh. I won't be able to speak out of fear. And then he concluded that sentence 15, l'mishofti eschanan, am I going to appeal to the one who judges me? Which Ralbag understands as a question. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 1, he says, ve'eich et chanan al Hashem yisbarach. How am I going to plead to God? Hineim karasi vayaaneni, lo amin ki yazin koli. If I were to call him to answer me, that vayaaneni doesn't mean he answered me, but rather, even if I were to call him to answer me, I wouldn't believe that he would actually listen to my voice. Why? Lihiyoti pachot me'od biyachas elav. Because I am so small in comparison with him. I'm so small compared to God that I can't believe that God is going to listen to me. You follow? That's his statement. God isn't listening to me. He doesn't listen to the mighty. He's sure not going to listen to me. And he concludes the thought in sentence 16, Im karasi vayaneni, if I were to call to him to answer me, lo amin ki azin koli. That's actually what Rabbah just quoted. I wouldn't believe that he would hear me. So my first point, says Eo, my first reason for why I can't win is because I can't even state my claims in the first place. And the reason I can't state my claims is because God's not listening. And when no one's listening to you, you don't really want to say anything, right? I should spill out my heart and talk about how I've been righteous. For what? God's not listening anyway.
This is not unique to Job.
Oh, no. Job is meant, and certainly if you take the view that he's a parable, you know, but even if he's not a parable, even if he's a person, events and statements in general make it into Tanakh because the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah say this is something that's going to resonate with people and have meaning for their lives. He is by far not the only one. I can't tell you how many people I heard over my years in the rabbinate say to me that prayer is difficult for them because how can I say this if I don't think anyone's listening on the other side? Absolutely. The only difference, I think, between what he's saying and what people normally say is that he's saying it as an accusation. What people normally say, at least what I've heard people say, is, I don't believe there's someone listening on the other side. I can't really believe that. Whereas what he's saying is that God is malicious, and therefore he's not listening to me. He's out to crush, he's out to harm, or I am so far beneath him. If you take that read, which we're going to come back to, there's more to be said with that.
He's taking it more personally than what you're saying.
Yes. That's my experience and what I've seen. Of course, you know, your mileage may vary, or kilometrage may vary. Rita.
We don't believe that God is listening.
Who's we? We meaning Job, or we meaning us? I would distinguish between what Jews are supposed to believe and what Jews believe. In all seriousness, meaning if you ask me, yes, absolutely, Tanakh and everything thereafter tells us that God is listening. But human beings don't necessarily feel that to be their experience. And Job certainly doesn't feel that to be his experience. And that's wonderful.
Hang on.
This could be a lot of fun, but not in the way that I want it to be. The question of whether people perceive it to be that way is so dependent on so many different factors. It is based in part on personal experience. It's based on personality. It's based on, you know, what one has learned and how one has been able to apply it or not. It's based on so many different factors. But the first point that I think certainly is true is yes, from a Jewish tradition standpoint, we are taught God is listening. However, I was actually too general with that. And the however is an important however. There is a school of thought, and Rambam is its most pronounced and most well-known supporter, that says that God only listens to certain people's prayers. That only if you've achieved a certain level is God going to actually, you know, listen to it. So don't, you know, whether you agree with him or not, I want to make sure that I don't present things as 100% one way, you know, when it's not true. There is an alternative.
Rambam,
Maimonides. Yes. Yes, without a doubt. Without a doubt, there is a difference between listening and answering. Now, I would question whether somebody who's suffering cares about the difference. Because remember, it's not just about answering. Job feels that he's being actively attacked. So, it isn't enough for God to say, I'm listening and I'm just not responding. Because his answer is, you are responding, you're hitting me.
You know, he wants to know why.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, if someone were to go to Job and say the classic answer of no is an answer also, right? If people were to say that to Job, Job's answer would be, I would take a no. I'd be glad to have a no, but I'm not getting a no from God. I'm getting a slap from God. And saying, no, I won't help you, is much better than saying, I'm actually going to continue to attack you. Which is what he's enduring. It's much harder, what he's dealing with. Saying to Job, no is an answer to, isn't going to help him. I think that's important. If God would simply leave him alone, as he puts it, I'd be very happy. You know, I think it's a different experience that he's having. So he absolutely is of the belief that God's not listening, and that God thinks he won the debate already, and that that's why he's getting struck, and that Bildad doesn't know what he's talking about. That's fundamentally Job's perspective. But he's not done. That's his first reason why he can't win. He has a second reason why he can't win, and that's coming up in sentences 17 to 18. And that is because God is aggressive. He says, Asher bisara yishufeni vihirba pitzai chinam. Now, there are two ways you can translate the beginning of that sentence. I believe most translate it as, in a storm, or in a mighty wind, or in a whirlwind, he crushes me, and he increases my wounds for nothing. Does anyone have a different term in the first half of that sentence besides storm, whirlwind, and so on? How else could you translate that, if no one does? What is a sa'ara?
Storm.
What else? Not a storm.
A hair.
Sorry. Sayara is a hair. Sayara is hair. Flower? Flower? Like perach?
No.
Oh, kemach.
Different
word. Yeah. Right. Well, this word is with a sin. Look at the sentence. This word is with a sin. That doesn't bother us, because sin and samach do interchange, and you see it quite a bit in Eo. So that's not, that in of itself won't be an issue. The Omer offering is barley. And the chatat, certain of the chataot are. Well, it's got a cholam in there between the ayin and the resh, se'ora. It would be written malay. But in any case, the se'ora as a hair, also, you'd be hard-pressed to explain to me, with a barley, he crushes me. He's suffered an awful lot, but I didn't think that had happened. Maybe it's a reference to the cholam, I don't know. The asher b'se'ora yishufeni is, according to some readers, for a hair, as in a hair's breadth, he crushes me, meaning even if I get the slightest thing wrong. The expression we use is chut ha-se'ara, or chut ha-se'ar. The idea that Hashem judges people who are close to him on a very fine level. And even if they deviate by a hair, he's going to zap them for it. So some will say that that's what he's saying here. God will punish me even for se'ara, even for being a hair off of where I should be. But the general consensus is the first way that we said it, which is bisara yishufeni. In a storm he will crush me. V'hirba p'tza'ai chinam. And he increases my wounds for nothing. I'm going to come back to the se'ara in a second. I just want to finish the thought in Pasuk Yud Chet, sentence 18. Lo yitneni hashev ruchi. He will not let me settle my spirit, my breath. Ki yasbi'ani mamrorim. Because he fills me, he sates me with bitterness. There is so much going on within this second allegation. His second allegation, first of all, I didn't mention this before. You may have noticed, he's starting to use the word im an awful lot. He used it in Pasuk Ted Vav, he used it again in Pasuk Ted Zion, sentence 16. He's going to use it again twice in sentence Yud Tet, 19. He's going to use it again in Chaf, and again in Chaf Gimel, and so on. And the reason this is striking is because that was a Bildad word. Bildad throughout his speech was heavy on the ims. If you go back to chapter 8, the beginning of the chapter, he used im in sentence 4, sentence 5, sentence 6, as this, well, if you're good, and if you turn to God, and if your children sinned, right? And so he's sort of throwing it back in the face of Bildad, which he's done before. We've seen him do that before. We saw him do that in the beginning of this chapter when he quoted Eliphaz verbatim. He likes to do that in general. It was in sentence 10. He quoted Eliphaz verbatim, but he used the sentence in the opposite way. So he's sort of mocking Bildad, who used the im to make his claim, and he's using the im as part of his response. Im literally could be translated as if or when, depending on how it's used. But in terms of what he's actually saying here, beyond the language, He says, God crushes me with the whirlwind. He increases my wounds. He tortures me. He doesn't give me a moment to breathe. In other words, what he's saying, what Job is saying is, I can't make my claim because I physically can't make my claim. You're telling me I should turn to God and appeal to God. I can't even speak. He won't give me a moment to breathe. There's no opportunity for it, is his second point. But there's deeper stuff going on here. You catch the whirlwind reference in sentence 17. Why is that important?
He already had something like that beginning.
We haven't yet had a whirlwind. We've had Ruach Gadol. We had a great wind, yes.
But this will be at the end also.
In the end, correct. We're going to have this. Are you going to say also?
God answers and I heal out of the whirlwind.
Yes. God is going to respond to him from a whirlwind. So take a look at source number 2, please. The Talmud grabs this one. This passage, Bava Batra 16a, we've used it quite a bit because this is the Talmud's main page on which it discusses lines from Job. Amar Rabba, the sage Rabba said, Iyov b'sa'ara cheref, u'b'sa'ara heshivuhu. Job blasphemed with the great wind or storm, whatever you want to call it. And with the storm, God responded to him. They is the plural. Heshivuhu is the word. It's a they. Bisara cheref. He blasphemed with a storm, with the wind. Dichtiv, as the pasuk says, we just read it. Asher bisara yishufeni. He would break me. He would crush me with a great wind. Amar lefanav. He said before God, Ribono shel olam, master of the universe. Shema ruach se'ara avra lefanecha v'nitchalef lecha bein Iyov le'oyev. He makes an interesting allegation to God. What happens is the Talmud, using that ear of Medrash, says it's really odd that Job speaks of being crushed with a whirlwind. He hasn't been crushed with a whirlwind. That hasn't happened. It's true that we talked about blowing down the house upon his kids, but Job has not been crushed with a whirlwind. So what it suggests is not that he was crushed in a whirlwind, but he was crushed as a result of a whirlwind. How could you be crushed as a result of a whirlwind? Well, maybe there was some confusion, God, and you got confused between Iyov and Oyev. Iyov is his name, Job. Oyev is the Hebrew word for enemy. So maybe you got confused. Remember, we said this in the beginning of the year when we started the book. We noted that among those who read this as a mashal, as a parable, they suggest the names all are meant to hint to things about their character. And Iyov is the enemy of God, hence Iyov Oyev. So that's what the Talmud, that association is what's being picked up on here when he says this to God, and that's blasphemy. What do you mean God got confused? And so b'sara heshivuhu, God is going to respond to him with a great wind. Vayana shemet Iyov min ha-se'ara, when God answers him from the wind, because the answer that God gives him is a rebuke, fundamentally. What God is going to say to him in the end is going to be harsh in response to this statement of his. So he says, God doesn't allow me even to catch my breath. The Dat Mikra points out also there's an element of irony in the image in that he says, God has a whirlwind at his disposal. He won't let me even have my ruach, my breath. You know, he's got all the wind and he won't let me have just the air in my lungs. He's got to have everything. That was a very sharp thing that Amos Chacham noted. The other thing to note here, we've seen quite a bit already about how passages in Job will reflect passages elsewhere in Tanakh. So here, Yasbi'ani Mamirorim, at the end of sentence 18, he fills me or he sates me with bitterness or bitter things. That's almost a direct lift from Lamentations, from Echa, chapter 3. Hisbi'ani Bamirorim Hirvani La'ana, he has sated me with bitter things. And of course, this being a lament, it makes perfect sense. I can't think of two books that belong together more than Job and Lamentations, right? Iyov and Echa. Yes, Sharon.
Just have to ask a question about the use of blasphemy.
Yes.
Rava said Job blasphemed. But it's not in here.
What do you mean?
Well, the word blasphemy.
No, he's making an observation about Job's language. But Job says to God...
Okay, so that's exactly what I don't understand.
Yeah. Right. So the way this word has been used, you know, previously, because we've seen other passages that did similar things from the same page in the Talmud, is making an accusation that God is unfair, or certainly that God is antagonistic, qualifies. The general rule is that blasphemy is when someone makes a statement about God that is negative, saying bad things about God. Give me an example of something that you'd ask about. I feel bad saying anything because anything is too broad a word. But if you give me an example. Saying God is malicious qualifies, you know, as saying something blasphemous about God. Yeah.
Even now.
Why should there be a distinction?
Because in theology, I thought there were certain discussions that are now allowed.
Discussions are different from statements, right? In other words,
really a discussion. Job is having a discussion.
Is he?
As much as they're having a discussion with him.
You know what? I'll tell you what. So I would say to hold off on the question of a discussion until we get to source number 7. Because I think, bring it back when we talk about number 7, because there I think it's going to add a very important dimension to this question. So hold off, but don't hold off too long. You'll see. I think source number 7 is going to be very important for the question that I think you're asking.
Is it blasphemous to say that God is blasphemous?
Well, yeah.
That what?
Yeah.
What did you say?
To say that, Joyce said, asked, is it blasphemous to say that God isn't listening? So I think that would qualify. Let me make sure that I'm being clear here, because I have the funny feeling that I'm not, or that I'm sounding like I'm saying something I'm not saying. My point is not to say that a human being can't wonder about things. My point is to say that a human being doesn't have the right to make definitive statements along certain lines. King David, the Talmud has a classic line where it's talking about, the Talmud in Gittin is talking about the Jewish rebellion against Rome and how there was a certain leader of the Jewish rebellion, a military leader by the name of Bar-Daroma, and he makes a statement that God has abandoned us. God has abandoned us, he doesn't fight for us anymore. And because of that, as the Talmud tells the story, he is punished and he meets a terrible end. And the Talmud, one of the sages there, asks a question. He says, well, King David said that already. Lo yitzei Elokim b'tzivotenu. God doesn't go out with our armies. King David said it. So what's wrong with this fellow Bar-Daroma saying it? And for the answer to that question, you have to wait till we get to source number 7, because it's going to matter. But there's a distinction between saying it one way and saying it another way, which I think is critical. Shana.
But isn't this getting close to the idea of Hester Panim? The idea that there are times when God turns a face away from us and really ignores us, sets us loose in the natural world.
So Hester Panim, as I understand it, doesn't mean ignores us, right? What's the literal translation of Hester Panim?
Hiding the face.
Right. Hiding one's face doesn't mean that he's not seeing. It means that we can't see him. Right, that's always what the little kids have trouble with, right? You can't see me. But that's the claim of Hester Panim is you won't see me, not I won't see you. But let's go a little further with this, because there's so much that we have to see here and to inform the very important question that Sharon is asking. So he has said two things. Number one, he said, I can't voice it to God because he's not listening to me. Number two, he says, there's no opportunity. He doesn't even let me breathe, let alone speak. Although I think he's doing a good job of speaking, frankly. For a guy who's got no breath, you know, he's doing okay. But he then continues to say in sentence 19, Pasuk Yud Tet, I can't get a date in court. In Lekoach Amitz, Hine. There are a couple of different ways to take this sentence. I'm going to take it as Rashi does. In Lekoach Amitz, Hine. Ve'im Lemishpat, Mi Yoideni. He says, if what's right is determined by being strong, right? If might makes right, So, God, hine, it's there already. God has it. There's no point. I can't have a conversation with God if victory is determined by who's stronger. Ve'im le'mishpat. And if you're going to tell me that it's about who's right, mi yo'ideini, who's going to give me a mo'ed? Who's going to give me an appointment in court to speak to God? It's just not there. If you take a look on your sheet, I brought you Rashi in source number 3. He says, Ech ariv imo, how am I going to fight with him? Im lekoach hu ba, amitz hinehu. If we're to look for strength, right, he's mighty. V'im lemishpat, and if it's for justice, miyuhala ho ideni lefanav ulachzik devar mishpati. Who's going to arrange for a time for me to speak to God and strengthen my case? It's not. It ain't going to happen. There's no option. Here's another case where he uses positive language about God in a negative way. He calls God amitz, right? Koach amitz. V'im lekoach amitz. If for the for being mighty. God is mighty. God is called Amitz Koach in Tanakh. He actually also called God Amitz Koach earlier in this chapter, in sentence 4. That's usually a positive statement about God when we call God Amitz Koach. In on Yom Kippur, traditionally in the Avodah, part of the Musaf service on Yom Kippur, the repetition of the Musaf, includes a description of the Kohen Gadol service in the temple on Yom Kippur. And it begins with a very long poem. And one of the standard poems that's used in many Ashkenazi communities begins with Amitz Koach. That's the way we identify God as being mighty and creating the world and so on. And that's the phrase he's using, but once again, he's using it in the negative. And he concludes his thought in this section by saying in sentence 20, Im etzdak, even if I'm right, even if I have a righteous claim, a victorious claim, pi yarshieni. My mouth is going to make me wicked. Tam ani vayakisheni. I am tam. I'm complete. I read the first sentence of my book, and it said, I am ish tam viyashar, the vayakisheni, and God has made me out to be wicked. It's a very interesting statement. There are two approaches to the statement of P-R-C-A-N-E, my mouth will make me out to be wicked. Wicked. One approach is Mitzudat David. The other approach is Rashi. If you take a look at source number 4, Mitzudat David says it's actually a question. P-R-C-A-N-E, shall my mouth make me out to be wicked? Meaning, V'chi bavur mei P-R-C-A-N-E-Hashev l'Rasha. Will I be considered wicked because of my questions? Because, as Sharon noted, because I'm saying things, now you're going to tell me I'm a bad person? That's halo me'atzmi anitam v'yashar. I'm a complete and righteous guy on my own. V'hu aso tili ikesh. He made me wicked. V'hava'ata yisrim alo chamas. By causing me to suffer for having done nothing wrong. Don't look at me for my words. I am only reacting. That's the way that that Mitzudat David reads it. Rashi says says it differently. He says, "Im etzdak, even if I were righteous, pi yarshieni, my mouth would define me as wicked, ki yisatmu dvarai mi yirah, because my words would be sealed from fear. I am so afraid of God that I can't speak." Again, that. Belies the book. But he says, I can't say what I need to say to God. I'm too intimidated to say anything before God. He has the might to do whatever he wants to me. So therefore, I'm not able to say anything. So in sum, what he has said here is a direct response to Bildad. Bildad said I should approach God, but there's no point. I can't convince God, whether he's listening, not listening, it doesn't matter. I can't convince God of my righteousness. That's what he's saying in this section. But he's not done. He's just getting started. He continues to say, and this is the rest of the chapter pretty much, the world is run wickedly. And so he reiterates in sentence 21. He says, Tamani lo eda nafshi em as chaya. He insists, I am Tam. Right? I am the righteous person I was made out to be. Lo eida nafshi. Now the phrase lo eida nafshi is a really hard phrase. Literally, you would translate it as? Right, I don't know myself. Which makes no sense. I mean, unless you're going to take the view, which we cited from Carol Newsom a while back, that he's just so grief-stricken and traumatized, he doesn't even know what he's saying. But I think that you don't need to read it that way. And the commentators, I brought you a selection in source number 6. Rather than bring you each commentator, I just brought you a little a summary of what each one understands this to mean. I am righteous. I don't know myself. Emas chayai, and I reject my life. So Ibn Ezra says, it's a question. Tamani, I am tam. Lo eidan nafshi, don't I know myself? Don't I know that I am tam? Don't I know that I'm righteous? Or alternatively, not as a question, but still as an affirmation that he's righteous. I don't know of any evil I've done. I know myself pretty well. Lo eidan nafshi, I don't know of anything bad within myself. So Ibn Ezra takes it as strengthening his point that he is a tam. Mitzudat David takes the word nefesh and says that's not necessarily the way to read the word nefesh. Think of Ubayom HaShavi'i Shavat Vayinafash, the idea that for six days God creates the world, and on the seventh he halts. Vayinafash is a halting which we associate with rest. And nofesh, exactly. Nofesh lenafshi. In which of the songs is that? Oh, Kiyashmar Shabbat. Right. Nofesh lenafshi, rest for my soul. So he takes it that way. Mitzudat David says, Lo eidan nafshi, I don't know how I'm ever going to find rest. I am righteous, and yet, God won't let me rest. Malbim takes it as, maybe I don't know myself. I think I'm tam, but maybe God knows more than I do about who I am. And then finally, Dan Mikra, he takes Eda differently. Lada doesn't have to mean to know. It could also mean to have a close relationship with somebody. The Adam Yadat Chava Ishto, there are various times. So Dan Mikra says, I won't have mercy on myself. I just gave you a brief summary of it just to show you just how far you can go in explaining these sentences. Some of these sentences are just so hard to translate. But he says, I am righteous. What's meant to emerge from sentence 21 is, I am righteous, and regardless of what anybody else says, I believe this to be true. There's also a level here of response to Bildad. If you flip back quickly to chapter 8, sentence 20... Sorry? You're voting for Malbim. Okay. It has an appeal. I hear that. Chapter 8, sentence 20. Right? What did Bildad say? Chapter 8, sentence 20. What did Bildad say? Someone tell me in English.
God does not detest the wholesome.
Right. God does not detest the tam. God doesn't detest the tam. God will not reject the tam. So he says, here I am, tamani. if God doesn't reject the tam, can you explain what's going on in my life? That's essentially what he's saying. What? Do I not know that I'm a tam? Why? What you're saying doesn't make any sense, Bildad. It doesn't match the world around me. And he continues now to say, regardless of Bildad who said that bad things people don't get crushed, and Eliphaz said that the good people are not totally crushed. Bildad said that righteous people, God's going to take care of them, and the bad isn't really bad, and so on. So he said, I have news for you. Harm befalls the righteous and the wicked alike. He says in sentence 22, Achas hi, it's all one. Al-Kain Amarti, and that's why I said, in response to you, Bildad, Tam Varasha Hu Mechale. God destroys the righteous, and God destroys the wicked, and your statement that God will not reject the Tam, frankly, does not hold water. That's his statement. There are two different approaches to this, as always. One approach saying that he's talking about the stars doing this, the other approach that it's God doing this, but without getting bogged down in that, he says, God is destructive to everybody. Imshot, in sentence 23, although I'm not done with 22, but just to finish this section. Imshot, yamit pitom. If the rod will kill suddenly, lemasat nikiyim yilag, he will mock the destruction of the righteous. I'm going to come back to that also. But the last thought here is in sentence 24, where he gives you the triple clause sentence. Eretz nitna biyad rasha. The land is given in the hands of the wicked. Pnei shofteha yechaseh. The face of its judges, he covers. There's no honesty. There's no justice. Imlo, if not, eifo mihu, if it's not him, if it's not the wicked who's doing it, then who is it who is committing all of this? Who is it who is crushing the righteous? It's got to be God slash the stars, as we've talked about. So, going back now to sentence 22, when he says, God destroys the righteous and the wicked. And now we turn to source number 7. Amar Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Levi says, a medrash in Bereishit Rabbah, Shnei bnei Adam amru davar echad. Two people said the same thing. Abraham, v'Iyov, Abraham and Job. Abraham said, when God told him he was going to destroy Sodom, Chalilalach me'asot kadavar hazeh. It would be a desecration, it would be a disgrace for you to do this. Lahamit tzadikim rasha, to kill the righteous with the wicked. Iyov amar, achasi alkein amarti tam v'rasha u'michaleh. As we just read, Job said it's all one. Thus I have said, he destroys the righteous, he destroys the wicked, all together. So, Abraham, natal asachar, but Abraham was rewarded for what he did. Iyov, ne'enash aleha, Job was punished for what he did. Parenthetically, I don't know where Abraham is rewarded for his defense of Sodom. I don't remember a particular event that, in which Abraham is rewarded. The answer may be just be that it's just contrasting it with Job. Hashem, the saving of Lot isn't necessarily a function of his defense of Sodom. And Hashem listens to him, but in the end says no. Right? Hashem's answer to him is no, fundamentally.
But Job is punished before he says.
Right, is Job punished further for this? So I think what this is meant to say is not these lines are the good and the bad, or the triggers of the good and the bad, but rather that these lines reflect their personalities, which are the cause for what they generally experience. In other words, this is taking the view that Job is a bad person. Not a bad person, I shouldn't say that. This is taking the view that Job is actually being punished for something and deserves what he's experiencing. So he says, what's the difference? Abraham Amar Bishula. There are a couple of different editions. I stuck with the one that I have. Abraham said something mature. Iyov Amar Paga. Whereas Iyov said something that was underripe. The word Bishul is used in the context of fruit. To Bishvat tonight. Why not? The word Bishul is used to refer to the ripening of fruit. Yeah. If Shilavash Kotah Anavim. So, The question is, what exactly are they trying to say here? What's the distinction that's being drawn between Abraham and Iyov? It's true. Abraham's statement is, you said you're going to destroy Sodom. I believe that would be an injustice. I believe that will be destruction of the righteous with the wicked. Maybe there are righteous people there. And God says, yeah, I took that into account. There are no righteous people there. As Abram goes down the list, and is not able to get a yes out of God until finally he gives up. What's the difference between what Abraham does and what Iyov does? Yeah.
Well, maybe it's just the tone Abraham uses. Chalila l'chan, like he's more respectful. Maybe he's more humble, and maybe Iyov is just more antagonistic, argumentative. I don't know.
No, I think that's a major point. Abraham's approach is respectful. What else?
It's very true.
Sorry.
It's very true, but it's a lot easier to talk about somebody in the third person than when it's actually happening to you. So we're faulting Eo for his response because it was so bitter, but the bitter stuff was happening to him.
Mm-hmm. Quite true. It's certainly true in the context of Abraham versus Iyov in this, and in the two cases that we are given in this midrash, that is certainly true. Iyov is being faulted for something personal. You know, it may be easier to be academic about it, or to be to be not academic, but to be distanced from it, because it's that city over there instead of being. And it's interesting, by the way, Abraham doesn't make a claim for Lot at all. Abraham doesn't say boo about his brother-in-law. It happens to be that his brother-in-law gets out, and yes, it's credited to the family, but Abram didn't say anything. Joyce, what were you going to say?
I can say the same thing that one is in the first person for me.
Right. Right. What, yeah?
The other idea also that Avraham is sort of arguing on behalf of Hashem's reputation, that, you know, we don't want Hashem's head among the goyim, that, you know, now we can blaspheme God because of what a terrible thing he did, as opposed to Eov, who's specifically trying to...
If I take it as being about reputation, that's the suggestion that Avram is saying, well, it wouldn't be, you know, it would be a bad thing for you because it would cause people to say, then that means he doesn't disagree with the action, right? It means that he agrees with what God is going to do, but he says it's bad PR, right? And I don't think that rings true with what he says to God, because if so, what is the whole business with the 50 righteous people or the 40 righteous people? Like, I'm not sure that fits. It also raises the bigger question of, well, if what people say about God is accurate, how can that be bad PR? That is who he is.
In Abraham's response induces self-reflection. God hasn't done it yet. He's going to do it in the future. Job's response is, it's a giver.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Job is talking about something that's already happened. Avram is talking about something that has not yet happened. He's trying to prevent something from happening in the future. Also good.
And he's also, I think, talking about other people. This one is privately.
Right, that's what Dan and Joyce said. It may be easier to be Abraham in this scenario. So I think all of these things have truth to them. What I would note, and what I think that they're picking up on here, and we sort of danced around it a little bit, is that Abraham doesn't make a direct accusation of God as being unjust. He criticizes the action, not the actor. You know, this would be beneath you, God, to do this. That's not the same thing as saying, God, you're evil for doing this. Those are two different things. And I think that's a critical distinction between the two. And that brings me back to the story that I mentioned about the rebellion against the Romans and Bar Daroma. Because when the Talmud asks, well, didn't King David say the same thing that Bar Daroma did? The Talmud's answer is, King David asked it as a question. Why don't you go out with our forces anymore, or aren't you out with our forces anymore? As opposed to Bar Daroma, who says, God isn't helping us anymore, as an affirmative declaration. And so that brings me back to the question that Sharon posed earlier of, are we allowed or not allowed to engage in such discussions? Are you telling me that these discussions are then off limits? I think that there is a distinction to be drawn between a statement of God is X, God is malicious, God is harming me, whatever it is, and a statement of, I don't understand how this could be happening. It makes it look like God is against me, God is harming me, and so on. I think the latter is an honored piece of Jewish tradition that isn't new. I think that's the fact that we have this book in Tanakh is evidence that this is a very old part of Jewish debate. I think that where the Talmud says, wait, that's blasphemy, is when someone thinks he's come to a conclusion and is willing to make it as a direct assertion. I think that's where the line is drawn. Go ahead. You can say it. All right, then I'll say it for you. Then what you're doing is you've limited the discussion from the outset because certain conclusion, I know. You've been learning here on Tuesdays how long? Then there are certain conclusions that you've already ruled out from the beginning of the discussion, and the discussion is now, it's not a discussion anymore.
Semantics.
Yes.
You're only allowed to debate within a framework of certain words.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a question of semantics.
Right. And I agree. I agree. Without a doubt, I wouldn't say it's just semantics. I think there's more to it than that. Because on one extreme, we've ruled out saying that, I've concluded that what God does is maliciously, wrong. On the other hand, there's an awful lot of space between that and a build-out approach of everything is rosy. And all the bad things are really good, you just don't know how. Or an Eliphaz approach of, there's a narrative of hope in every situation and God's looking to help you. I think that there's still room in between. I, think Job gets into trouble Talmudically. And again, I want to make sure to stress, this is one approach to Eov. It is not the only approach to Eov. But the but what he gets in trouble for is his certainty.
So that's why you have to say he was silent until he could not hold it back.
Yeah.
Until he heard certain theological statements that...
Yeah, it so offended him that he just had to... Yeah, no, I tend to agree. He got pushed over the line. He didn't walk. I think so.
Isn't it bottom line? Isn't it intent? Because I'm right now reading a book of Zephina's, Women's Zephina's, and they're so lovely, and they're so personal. And in some of them, they really do challenge.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
With love.
Right. Joyce is talking about tchinot or tchinas. Tchinot is probably the wrong word to use because it was such a Yiddish thing. You can't really say it in Sephardit. But a tchina was a prayer, like tachanun, the women's prayers that were... I don't even know if there's a book of it. Interesting. Interesting.
Such a nice book.
Okay. But in terms of what's going on then here, and this statement that's been made... Job makes this statement that God destroys the righteous and the wicked. And then in sentence 23, he said, if, he's still using Bildad's if against him, he says, if the rod will kill suddenly.
There it says when the rod.
Right, because again, Ian could be if or when. Either way, it's still Bildad's weapon. But he says, "Lemasat nikiyim yilag, he, meaning the wicked, will mock the destruction of the righteous." So two different ways to take this. One way to take it is simple. The righteous are struck down, and the wicked mock them. But Mitzudat David and Ralbag have another take, which is deeper. If you take a look at source number 8, the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, English at the top of the next. Av lefi dvarecha. He says to Bildad, even according to you, okay, even within your view, Asher Shevet Hamakeh Yamit Pitom Et Harasha, Kasher Yikabel Dei Gemul Me'ad Maaseh Ato She'asa. According to you, the rod is going to kill the wicked suddenly when he receives the reward for whatever little good deed he did. According to you, the wicked is struck down by the shoat, by the rod. And not so, he will not hasten to kill the righteous. It's actually not a response to Bildad, come to think of it. It's a response to Eliphaz, really. Eliphaz was the one who said this. But he says, "Halo gamzos o letova yechashev laharasha." He says, I have news for you. Even if you're going to tell me that the wicked are killed immediately, whereas the righteous aren't killed, right, because they're going to ultimately survive, that's a favor to the wicked also. Because he laughs and he mocks the righteous people who suffer for long periods of time. Frankly, he would say it would be better in his eyes to die suddenly than to suffer in this way. He'd be happier with the Russia's fate. That's the way that they take this line, seeing greater depth in the complaint that Eov is making. And so he says, in a classic line, "Eretz nitna biyad Russia." The land is given over to the wicked. And once again, whether that means God, or that means the stars that God has put in charge, depending on which way I read Eov in general. In source number 9, you see that Malbim says it's talking about the stars. Umefaresh, Job explains, Mihi hahanhagazot she'eretz nitna biyad rasha. Who is it who is this governor? Who is it that is governing the land when the land is given to the wicked? He hanagat hamarechet hanoheget barasha. That beresha. That is the government of the constellations, which governs wickedly. And so he goes on, "Umedamez zopim litzato kemelech gadol tzadik asher masar hanagat ha-medina biyad moshel rasha v'hit naheg b'resha v'achzariyut." He says, Eov is comparing what God has done by putting the stars in charge to a king who is personally righteous, but he put an evil governor in charge. So that doesn't cleanse you of your responsibility, God. If you've really done this, then you are indeed to blame. That's the argument that he makes. And so he concludes this section. Well, he doesn't conclude yet. It would take us a little while to conclude the section. But he says, continuing in sentence 25, still observing the wickedness that goes on. He says, I see nothing good, and I have no hope. V'amai kalu mini ratz. Barchu l'ra'u tova. He says, my days are so swift in their passing. My days are just flying by faster than one can run. They flee. Barchu is an image of flight, like they're fleeing from something evil. Right? So he says, my days are fleeing. Lo ra'u tova. They have never seen something good. This is, like he said in his response to Eliphaz, I won't make you look back at it now, but in chapter 7, sentence 6, he said to Eliphaz, Yamai kalu mini arek, my days are swift, swifter than the loom. Now he's saying, my days fly by swifter than somebody can run. I have no hope for the future. Cholfu amin im onios eveh. My days pass with anuyot eveh, which can be translated, I think I've seen, the two common translations I've seen are either reed boats or boats on a river called eveh. If anyone has anything different on theirs. Ralbag has a different idea of like will, but I haven't seen anybody but Ralbag. Swift boats. Okay. Kinesher yatus ale ochel, like a nesher flying after food. There's another one of the shin sin things. Yatus, we usually do it with a samach. A nesher is, of course, do not say eagle. We've discussed this before. A vulture, right? Nesher is popularly translated as eagle. For those who haven't heard this rant from me before, the people render nesher usually as eagle, and that sounds good when you say on the wings of eagles, I'm going to carry you all kanfei nesharim. Nonetheless, based on Rashi on the Talmud, it is clear, and it is brought as halacha, that a nesher actually is a vulture. Yeah, they're going to say, well, actually, that's really funny, that one. Because go back to Vayikra, Perek Yud Aleph. When it lists the non-kosher birds, and it lists the nesher, see if it says eagle or vulture. Yeah. Yeah. But yes, Camp Nesharim, you don't want to be called Camp Vulture. Nesher, you want to be Camp Vulture. And you don't want to be flying out of Egypt on the wings of vultures either. They all true. Nonetheless, what do they say there? It's Vayikra Yud Aleph.
Just as the nesher.
That's cheating. Translated as nesher. Okay. Nonetheless, the nesher is a vulture. Okay. Fine. The.
So, what's the difference between
Ayit
and
nesher? Isn't Ayit is a raven? No.
Ayit
is a raven. Yeah, a raven is a raven. Yeah, that's a raven. It's a different bird.
Yes, but Ayit.
Yeah, Ayid Zeh Orev Zeh Raven, Chashavti.
Ayid Zeh Vulture.
Vulture? Okay.
So the art scroll, yeah, in the commentary down below, says most commentators agree that the nesher is an eagle or a vulture.
Okay. I am outside the most. Yeah, well, the bearded vulture is the Paris, but that's another discussion.
Well, I have to tell you now.
Santino has a vulture. Okay. All right. In any case, enough ranting. What he describes here, look at what he said in this section. He says he brings images of speed. Right? His days fly by like reed boats on the water, or like a bird of prey pursuing food. Right? Two different images. The boat is propelled by something else, propelled by the wind. The vulture, or whatever bird this is, propels itself toward a goal. Two different images, and I think there's something behind that, but I want to go further in this section here. Im omri eshkecha sichi. There's that im once again. If I said I would forget my speech, I'm going to forget, not my speech, I'm sorry, forget my suffering. Siach could also be speech, but I'm going to forget what I'm going through. E'ezva fanai ve'avliga. I would stop all of this appeal and I would become strong. I'd make myself stronger. I'm going to gather strength. If I would say that, Yagorti kol atzvosai. Yagorti here is understood to be to gather, like le'egor. not lo taguru fear. Yagorti kolat losaya, would gather together all of my complaints, meaning so I won't complain anymore. I'm going to lock up all of my complaints in storage. Yadati ki lo tenakeni, I still know it wouldn't help, God. You wouldn't find me innocent. And here he's done something crucial. With that last word, he has done something crucial. What did he do with his last word in that sentence? That he has not yet done. Nope. He's not admitting guilt. The last word in the Hebrew. Tenakeni. It is second person. He has finally spoken a word to God directly. I know that you, until now, he spoke about God. Now he turns to God. The first time, as I recall it, he's done this in the book. And he says, even if I were to stop complaining and to put everything away and all that, it wouldn't help because you, God, would not find me innocent. Bildad has pushed him over the edge. That's what I'm getting at here. And so he says, there's no point, I see nothing good, there's no hope, there's no positive narrative, I'm not talking to God, nothing. And he concludes, now he does conclude the section, saying, Anochi Ersha, Lama Zehevel Iga. He says, I'm going to lose the case anyway. Rasha here is like the opposite of Tzaddik, where Tzaddik meant to be victorious. So Ersha means God is going to find me guilty. I'm going to lose the case in front of God. So he says, Lama Zehevel Iga. Why should I bother this futile attempt to justify myself? And he says, an incredible line here. He says, and he's still talking to God, Im hisrachatzti b'mei sheleg v'hazikosi b'vor kapai, if I would cleanse myself with snow, an image of purity, not that snow. If I were to cleanse myself with the water from snow, then I would purify myself b'vor kapai, with the purity of my hands, or bor is sometimes actually a detergent material. Az bashachat titbaleni, you know what you would do, God? You would immerse me in shachat. Shachat is a reference to the place of the dead. Shachat is a place to fodder, animal fodder sometimes. Lahashchit is corruption and destruction. You, God, you would immerse me in shachat. V'tiavuni salmotai, you would make my clothing to'eva, something abhorrent. He's a direct address to God. No matter what I do to try to be innocent, no matter what I do to argue on my behalf or to purify myself, you would make me filthy. As Rashi says, you would strive to find me guilty. Kilo ish kamoni enenu. He says, a man like me cannot respond to God, meaning I'm never going to be victorious. Nevo yachdav b'mishpat, to come to justice with God together. Lo yesh beinenu mochiach, there is no one who could be a mochiach, who could be the arbitrator who would say right and wrong between us. It doesn't exist. Yashes yado al shenenu, who could put his hand upon both of us and say, this is the one who is right. Don't tell me about a hope and approaching God. There is no chance. There's no chance. The last source that I bring you here on this is source number 10, another of these passages from that same page in the Talmud which we've been quoting all along, where he says, Lu yesh b'neinu mochiach yashed yado al shneinu, if there were only an arbiter between us, Amar Rav, Rav, the sage Rav says, Afro lepume de Iov, dust upon the mouth of Job, another rebuke for heresy. Klum yesh eved shemochiach es rabo, is there a slave who can instruct his master? I wish there was someone among us who could arbitrate and say, I'm good and God is not doing something good. By what right do you rebuke your master? And this is, once again, a charge of heresy against him. Granted all the justifications we've given for what he's going through and that it's personal and that he's suffering, the Talmud is trying to say something. And keep in mind, the Talmud is speaking to people who suffer on a Job level of suffering. The Talmud is talking to people who have suffered under the Romans every kind of brutality. And what it's saying is, there's a line. We don't get to be Job. We don't go that far. Like it or not like it, feel comfortable or not comfortable, I think that's the statement that's that's being made in this line. There's more to say about this. We'll have to come back to it next week. You haven't even seen anything in terms of where Job is going with this. We've seen the slightest tip of the iceberg thing. See you next week, God willing.
Thank you.